So it's the 1st of December 2009. I'm David Brooks, and today I'm talking with Diana Hammer, who is the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Region 8 Project Manager for Milltown, for the Milltown Superfund site.
Okay.
And I guess I'd like to begin with just a little bit about how you came to be involved with the EPA.
Oh, my. Well, I was a Peace Corps volunteer, and I... I didn't expect that question. When I was in high school, I was really interested in environmental issues, and I heard about the EPA, and I thought, oh, it seems kind of like a cool thing. I had a very good impression of the EPA as a high school kid. In college, I studied environmental, I went to a liberal arts school, so I got environmental studies, but took a lot of botany and biology. Then I was a Peace Corps volunteer, and after Peace Corps, you have a thing called non-competitive eligibility for federal jobs. And I had a bunch of friends who were working for the EPA, and I thought, maybe I could get a job with EPA. And that was in the early 90s, and a different time than it is now, when the jobs were more plentiful and EPA was hiring. And so as I looked in DC, and EPA headquarters was hiring, and I interviewed for a couple of positions, was offered a couple, and then I ended up working for the EPA Superfund program. So that's how I got to EPA. I started at a headquarters. While I was at headquarters, I went to graduate school in Baltimore at Johns Hopkins, and then I transferred, got a new job in Denver, Region 8 main office, and then when the Libby asbestos problem really hit the papers in November 1999, I started working up in Montana, and then I was hired the following year and actually moved to Montana. And so that's how I got to be with the Montana EPA.
What was it about the early 90s that made it such that there were all these jobs in the EPA and it was easier for you to get in? Any idea?
Yeah, I think the economy was different.
Mm-hmm.
The economy certainly now is, we haven't seen an economy like this for decades. So there was a time when there was a lot of awareness about environmental issues. EPA had a bunch of environmental laws to enforce. The Superfund program was about 10 years, it was created in 1980, so it was just over a decade old. It was really a time of expansion. There were a lot of environmental consulting firms forming at that time, and there was just a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very different than now. Now it's much harder to get into the federal government, and the environmental consulting firms are having a harder time too. It was just like everywhere.
And that, the change now, you're linking to the economy now, as opposed to a change in the emphasis on the environment?
Boy, I'm not an expert in this area at all, but my impression is that, specifically with Superfund,
mm-hmm.
The Superfund program had the fund was created with a tax on chemical feedstock, chemical industry, and that tax expired, I believe it was in 96, and we still had, our bank account, and which we continued to draw down on. And as with any bank account, if you're not continuing to put into it and you're drawing from it, by, I think it was 2003, that bank account was empty. And so now the funds for cleaning up Superfund sites where we cannot identify a responsible party or some company that did that actually polluted, those funds come directly from the general appropriation. So Congress appropriates money for Superfund cleanups as part of EPA's overall budget.
Mm-hmm.
And so money is just not as plentiful.
Whereas previously EPA had their own budget for that. Okay.
Superfund cleanups came. Uh-huh. The fund, where there wasn't a responsible party, like in Montana and in the West, I'm sure you have come across this, we have all this historic mining activity, and a lot of it was, mom and pop, or more pop, probably, historic mining, small claims, never amounted to much. The land has since been sold to someone, they've got a house on it or something. But part of that property may have some old mines, and you find some contamination. It's not the homeowner who now lives on the property. They didn't do it. It was this you know, somebody back in 1870. And so there's no one to pay for it. So that those kind of projects where you have more watershed contamination, those projects have to come out of, they're called fund leads. So the money to clean up those comes out of the fund,
mm-hmm.
Which is a smaller pot than it used to be.
So how about your first memories of Milltown once you came to Region 8? How did you get involved with Milltown?
Well, I'm newly the project manager. Mm-hmm. I was, Russ Forba was the project manager when I started with EPA Montana, and I was a community involvement coordinator. We worked very closely together. I started working with him in 2001, and my first memories of it were, you know, wow, this is really beautiful. Look at this cool old powerhouse. Look at this. This dam's kind of cool. Look at the reservoir. Isn't that pretty? And, you know, we walked around the site a lot and around the edges of the reservoir. And, you know, it was wet and mucky. We actually saw someone's pot growing operation down in there. And down in the reservoir where people just didn't go very often. But we were walking around. And that was probably one of my first impressions of it was just, wow, this is really beautiful. And there's all this cool history. And Bonner's a really quaint community with all the company houses along Highway 200. And I was really excited about the opportunity to work on a project where we were, 2001 was just starting to be mentioned then. Maybe one of the options might be dam removal. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, that'd be really cool. I've never worked on dam removal. Mm-hmm. So those were some of my early impressions.
So are those impressions sort of in juxtaposition to other Superfund sites, the idea that, wow, this is pretty? I mean, I think of Superfund and I think of some wasteland.
Yeah, in Montana we have some really beautiful Superfund sites. I mean, really, you know, it's kind of looking at the you know, some of the beetle kill.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't know that those trees are red, I mean, you can kind of imagine that they're red because of beetle kill. You think, oh, isn't that pretty?
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of the same way with Superfund sites in some ways. You know, we have the Clark Fork River going down through the Deer Lodge Valley. We have people who've come out from the East Coast saying, what's the problem? This is beautiful. Look at the blue sky, the blue water. They come out in the fall. We've got, you know, fields that are golden. We've got, you know, aspens and pines. And what's the problem?
Mm-hmm.
And then you say, well, see that area over there where nothing's growing? No, there's lots of copper. Or, you know, see, oh, look at the beautiful Milltown Reservoir. It's so glassy and you can fish there. Yeah, well, the contaminants in the reservoir sediments have polluted the local drinking water supply and they periodically kill fish. And it's beautiful on the surface, but it's not really beautiful when you look at the contaminants. So,
mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's kind of a funny thing that we have. It's kind of beautiful areas, but you know, it's not always visible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the contamination isn't. I've worked on yard cleanups where some places there had been mine waste that had been brought in. You know, visually you can see it's kind of golden. Nothing grows there. Clearly contaminated, or there's a problem in that area. Other areas, nice grass growing, you sample, there's contamination there too. So it's, you know, your eyes can fool you.
Mm-hmm. So let's go back, and I know you weren't at Milltown when it first got put on the Superfund's national priority list.
No, I wasn't. I hadn't even graduated high school.
Right. But could you explain a little bit how that works, how the EPA puts a site on the national priority list and how that ranking works?
Oh, sure. The Federal Superfund program has a list called the National Priorities List, NPL. And it is, you know, just as the name implies, it's the list of the worst hazardous waste sites in the country. And so the Superfund law was created in 1980, and they came up with a scoring system. You look at impacts to human health and impacts to the environment. And it's scored on a number of factors. Like you look at what contaminants are present? is there exposure pathway? Are there ways, you know, meaning that are there ways that those contaminants can get to a receptor, and that receptor can be, you know, people, or you know, animals, or other wildlife, or environmental receptors, ecological receptors, and so based on you look at that, you know, the size of the population potentially exposed can influence threats to public health way more heavily than ecological threats. Just because we have to prioritize, we're going to take care of people first. So it's called a hazardous ranking system, HRS score. And so you go through, you analyze all the information that you have, and the information is collected through something called a preliminary assessment. And then if you find something that looks like maybe you should do a little more, then the next step is a site inspection. PASI. And so you do go through the site inspection. If that still leads you to believe that, you know, there really is something here, we need to put together a scoring sheet. So they go through the HRS and listing process. So we have someone who specializes in listing Superfund sites. They look through all the PASI information. Some sites just naturally kind of rise to the top and say, you know, we need to look at these. Some we would look at them, we do a score sheet. It needs to score 28.5 or higher. If they score lower than that, we might refer them to the state, because the state of Montana has its own Superfund program called CECRA. We could say, yeah, you know, it's scored, but, you know, we could just say there's no further action. No further actions necessary. You know, we evaluated it, but there's nothing much we need to do here. For sites like Milltown or Superior, which was just listed, became our newest Superfund site this fall. For those sites, we say, wow, you know, it's scored. We've got completed pathways. We've got an exposed population. This is beyond something that the state should really be handling. We want to propose to put it on the national priorities list. And so we have a formal rulemaking process where we have a Federal Register notice. We list the sites that are proposed for the national priorities list. There's a formal public comment period. Public comment period closes. We evaluate the comments. And then based on what comments are received, you know, if there's strong opposition for good reason, you know, whatever it is, we may not proceed with finalizing that listing. Generally, once a site is proposed, the comments are usually in favor because there's clearly a problem and this seems to be the best way to take care of it. And then the next step would be to publish a Federal Register notice saying we have formally added like the Flat Creek Iron Mountain Mine or the Milltown site to the national priorities list. And so generally now that we would propose a site in March and it would probably become final in September propose in September and goes final in March. But it's generally a 6-month process between proposal and final.
And what about Milltown got it on there? Again, I know that's before your time there. But...
Oh, no, it's a fair question, though. There was a drinking water contamination at Milltown. It was discovered in 1981. Missoula County Health Department person was out sampling, found really high levels of arsenic in domestic wells. You know, everyone in Milltown is on well and septic, for the most part. So based on his findings, he alerted the state, and then the EPA was then contacted. And because the levels were so high and there was a population at risk, we did an evaluation, felt that immediate action was required. We put, so the site was proposed and then final, proposed in 82, final in 83. I think this process was a little slower than this brand new program. And then in 84, we put in a new well. We immediately got folks on, bottled water, but we, in 84, we put in a public water supply system. So we put in a well at Milltown and, formed a Milltown Water Users Association to manage that public water supply, and they've been doing that for the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm. How much of it is the public input part or public relations goes into getting a site on the national priority list? I know, having read back through letters, that it seemed like there were a lot of letters from Milltown, considering that, you know, it was 33 residents in question that were testing positive. It didn't seem like a large population. And so I wonder how much was it, I guess, the sort of public outcry, and how much of it was maybe that it was arsenic, that that's such a signature
arsenic and
poison,
old lace or
right? Yeah.
You know, I don't know. Mm-hmm. That was, that kind of stuff isn't really written down well, you mm-hmm. know, in our records. But I think part of the concern was the levels were really high. Arsenic's a carcinogen. You've heard of arsenic, the arsenic and old lace thing. You know, it can kill people. And the idea that it was in the groundwater, everyone was on wells, and what if that groundwater contamination spread to my well? So I think it was kind of an extrapolation of, oh gosh, you know, there's something nasty down there. What if it gets in my well? And, I've got kids, you know. I imagine it was that sort of mm-hmm. thing. And there was a lot of press about it at the time, too, so, you know.
So more kind of internal EPA stuff. How does the EPA, or how do you as a project manager, decide what to fund or who to fund when it comes to a site? Where does the money go? Who makes that decision?
Well, you know, the project manager ultimately is responsible for the site. I mean, that they have a team. The project manager has a team. There's the attorney, the community involvement person. There's our enforcement person who tries to find out what companies were responsible for this and who should we, you know, really send the bill to. So there's quite a team, and then we have our management chain too that has to approve decisions. And then we have our state counterpart, and at Milltown, so ultimately the decision of what to fund and what to pursue is the project manager's decision, you know, with input from many other parties. And those many other parties are the various state agencies, the DEQ, and now the NRD, MDT, they're involved. Milltown, at the confluence of the Clark Fork and Blackfoot Rivers, was a traditional hunting and fishing area for the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes, so they had hunting and fishing treaty rights, so they were involved as a site trustee. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was involved because of the Endangered Species Act and wetlands, because we had bull trout and eagle, bald eagles at the site. And then, of course, we were just, with the Milltown, the dam removal, we destroyed wetlands, which normally is a bad thing, but trading out artificially created reservoir wetlands for more natural river riparian wetlands, according to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, that was a good thing. So now it's off track. Another key player was Missoula County. The Clark Fork Coalition, also Missoula County and the Clark Fork Coalition, particularly the Clark Fork Coalition, had been advocating for dam removal for a long time. Missoula County also got behind that. So input from those folks, a group right after the listing of the Superfund site, Milltown Superfund site, there was a group called MESS, Milltown Environmental Superfund site. MTAG, Milltown Technical Assistance Committee, MTAC. Mm-hmm. MESS was something else. They did a paper called MESS. Anyway, so they got a grant from EPA to help the local community better understand, and by better understanding, better participate in site decisions, because, you know, we're very good at producing big documents. And so they got a tag, a grant early on, and then that group evolved into the Clark Fork River Technical Assistance Committee, mm-hmm. which has been active. I think maybe in the mid-90s they switched from MTAC to CFRTAC, and at that point they changed their name, I think, largely because they were looking not just at Milltown but at the river, because the whole Superfund site actually is the Clark Fork River, you know, downstream from Butte all the way to Milltown, but it's two Superfund sites. It's one Superfund site, two operable units, so two parts of one mm-hmm. Superfund site. So it's folks like that. Trout Unlimited was another. So we had and then the local community, Bonner Development Group, was very vocal. We got input from, you know, the PRPs, which are the potentially responsible parties, which turned out to be ARCO and Northwestern Energy. They certainly had input. And then the larger public in Missoula, and then in this project, we've had comments, we've had international and national attention on this project, so we've had input from lots of different places. Mm-hmm.
And how do you, I guess, go about deciding, again, who you're going to fund as the project manager? You have an MTAC that becomes CFRTAC. Mm-hmm. Do they come to you, or is that a group that comes to you and says, here's what we think we can do at this site? Are you willing to fund that, or do you go out and actively search for people or groups to spend Superfund money on?
The TAG, Technical Assistance Grant Program, was created with the amendments to Superfund in 1986, called SARA, Superfund Amendments and Reauthorization Act, SARA. And it really increased the public involvement requirements. Before that, there weren't that many, but in 86, SARA really added a lot. And one of the things they added was this grant for communities. And so part of the EPA has a requirement to let communities know that these grants are available. And so we publicize that, and then a group or multiple groups can come forward. And then in this case, it was just one group that came forward and applied. I don't believe there was any other group that was competing for it, but we can only award the grant to one group. And so we let people know that this grant was available, but we didn't target any groups to mm-hmm. apply for it. That was up to them. Mm-hmm. And some communities choose not to apply. CFRTAC, I would say, is one of the best most effective TAG recipients probably in the country. They have done an enormous job in getting information out. The combination of CFRTAC and the Clark Fork Coalition getting information out when we were about what we were thinking about doing, what we were proposing for the cleanup, what we reproposed for the cleanup. So in the period between 2001 and the end of 2004, when we made the decision, they did a ton of legwork. They sent out lots of postcards and had lots of meetings, and they really rallied their membership. And they support dam and sediment removal. So, and then in terms of what to fund and what to kind of even emphasize, you know, we try to, once a site is listed, we start what's called a remedial investigation and feasibility study. Those are the next two steps. And so we really want to, the point there is to understand what the contamination is and the feasibility study is, helps us lay out, well, okay, so we've got this problem, we think we understand it pretty well, what do we do? And so it lays out the alternatives for cleanup. And up until, you know, the site was listed because of public health risks from arsenic and groundwater. And up until the mid-90s, that's really what EPA focused on. We were really thinking about public health issues and how do we clean up the groundwater. And then in 96, there was that famous ice jam event Montana Power at the time was worried about taking out that the ice jam moving downriver might actually take out the dam. And people have pictures. And so they opened the dam up as much as possible so they could pass the ice. And in doing that, the ice, you know, kind of slowed down, came to this obstruction, which was the dam, and dug down and scoured reservoir sediments. And what we understand was happening periodically was during times of high flow or ice events, the reservoir would periodically scour, and in those reservoir sediments was, you know, levels of copper that were toxic to fish. I mean, fish are so sensitive. Even in minute quantities, fish are sensitive to copper. And in 96, it was just this very illustrative example of what had been happening periodically, like maybe every 5 to 7 years for much of the 20th century, mm-hmm. you know, where, you know, during a really high flow, you'd scour material, and in a low flow, you'd deposit. But so over the long term, you really weren't gaining or losing material from the reservoir. But in the specific events, you could scour down material that would kill fish. And what we saw in 96 was serious impacts to the trout and fish downstream of the Milltown Dam. And I'm trying to remember the numbers. You know, I think it was 70% of the juvenile trout died. So it was something like that. If you want to know the exact numbers, I can certainly look that up, or you can find it. But it wasn't just a few died. These were serious impacts. And at that point, EPA did something that is very, I think, hard sometimes for government to do, or anyone really. You find yourself on a project, you're working on something, you get well down a path, and you realize, we maybe should reconsider. And sometimes, whether it's painting your wall and you realize most of the way through that you hate that color, or you're on a project and you're most of the way done and, you know what? Folks have been telling us to look at downstream ecological impacts and we really haven't, but we should. So we stopped. We were all set to release the feasibility study and dam removal was not an option that was being considered. Why remove the dam, mm-hmm. We didn't. So we stopped. We had had a draft, a draft that was about ready to be released. And so we stopped and we did a focused feasibility study just looking at the downstream impacts. And what we found was, there are significant downstream impacts and we need to look at more options. The range of options we had been considering up until that point just wasn't sufficient. So we looked at more options, which now included dam modification and dam removal. And we issued a combined feasibility study, which took the first feasibility study and added the focus feasibility study. And so I think that came out in 2002. And that was the first time that we really started to seriously think, dam removal might be possible. And that was really quite an exciting time. I remember talking to Russ, the former project manager. I'm like, Russ, wouldn't that be cool? I mean, we could take out the dam and restore these rivers. And he's like, yeah. It was just sort of like, well, that's what the decision is, and that's what I'll do. And I was like, he was very unemotional about it, And I thought, wow, this would be so cool. I don't know. I like to raft and canoe. And so, it was kind of an exciting time.
You had said before we get started, I think that you were excited about the possibility of dam removal just as you came on and this evolved.
Yeah, I'd never worked on dam removal.
And you had never worked on one. Mm-hmm. Was there a history of dam removal in Superfund that you knew of?
No. No. This is not something that Superfund typically does, which is why I thought, that'd be kind of exciting. I've worked on a lot of, yard cleanups and things. But this was just new. And now, as we learned more about what the options were and we made the decision to take out the dam, looking at the possibilities for restoration and redevelopment of the area, it's a little mind-boggling. Not mind-boggling, but it's just very exciting. I mean, there's so much potential.
So is that when the idea about restoration and the way that we're seeing it happen now also started coming about, when the thoughts that, take out the dam, remove the reservoir?
Missoula County and the Clark Fork Coalition probably too had a lot to do with getting people excited about, wow, what could we have? And they, I think it was in 2002, they came out with the Two Rivers Park idea. Mm-hmm. And they were actually proposing a whitewater park for once the dam was out. They were planning to, I haven't looked at their plan for a number of years now, but they had different grade control structures and play areas, kind of like working off the idea of Brennan's Wave in Missoula, but just a lot of man-made structures in the river to create a really fun whitewater park. And a lot of communities in the West have done things like this, and probably all over in the United States, but like Clear Creek in Golden, Colorado, they've got one, and there's a bunch of them all over, where communities have really benefited from having kind of a play area where people can come in. Mm-hmm. And so I think they Missoula County and others promoted that idea, got a lot of really had legs, I guess. It got a lot of attention. It got people really excited about the possibility of it. But that was also about the time that I think we started really seeing a divide between the Missoula kayaker fly fishermen and the flatwater boater Milltown, more blue collar folks mm-hmm. in Milltown and Bonner. And it really almost was that clear. It was sort of the yuppie kayaker fly fisher people who wanted the park, the whitewater park, versus, hey, I like my flatwater and I like to fish for pike. And I live in Milltown. What are you doing in my town? You know, we really started to see more of a separation there.
Mm-hmm. So how did that play into, or did that play into what the EPA is doing? Because, I mean, ostensibly the EPA is supposed to be doing what's just best for the environment, human health concerns.
That's my phone. Yeah, go ahead. I'm not going to answer. I'm just going to turn it off. But, so how did that...
Or did that play into how the EPA approached what your decisions might be?
Well, you know, when the Superfund program first started, we were dealing with, I think, what you kind of envisioned, you know, when we first started talking, like maybe oozing messes or, you know, leaking barrels and drums or something. And over time, we realized that if we were going to clean up these Superfund sites, you know, we should be thinking about what, how that land could be reused in some beneficial way in the future. And so in the late 90s, Superfund started to really think about redevelopment. We didn't want to just have fenced off areas that were former Superfund sites that had 2 feet of clean soil, was nicely sodded, and no one could ever go in there. That just didn't seem like we had finished the job. We'd remove the, you know, people weren't being exposed. We'd address the human health or, you know, and environmental risks to the extent we could, but we needed to go farther. And so we started, EPA headquarters started a program looking at redevelopment and really promoting redevelopment. So in 2002, I started working with, there was a little bit of pilot money, and I approached headquarters. We got $40,000 from headquarters to help us start with a redevelopment group. And the Missoula County Commissioners actually appointed the first committee. It was called the Milltown Redevelopment Working Group. They're still around. We asked for 20 people broadly representative of the community. I worked with the steering committee to come up with an application, and the community reviewed the application and recommended appointees to the commissioners, and the commissioners then chose. So we had about 20 people broadly representative of the immediate community, and with some representation from Missoula, because the project really impacts more than just the local community. Local community is impacted most, but not, you know, uniquely or solely. And so we got a group, you know, we had people who were interested in fish and public health and parks and boating and local businesses and just as broad a group as possible. And we started meeting in 2002. The group was formed in 2003. And we said probably 6 meetings and then we'd be done. And so at that point, we didn't know if the dam was going to be, it was going to stay and be modified, nothing done with it, or be removed. We didn't know, but we made a ground rule that said, look, we are going to talk about the kind of community you want when Superfund is done and we leave, and when, you know, I leave, when EPA goes away. And so we identified community values. We talked about how the project, community values, and what kind of, what was their vision for the site in 5, 10, 50 years. And even people who were very much opposed on what should happen with the dam and the powerhouse, they came together with a pretty common set of values and a kind of a common vision of we want public access, we want open space, we want a community that is that's accessible to all ages and all incomes. They didn't want a boutique bedroom community. They wanted something that was pretty kind of like what they had now. Bonner School was really important to them. They wanted to make sure that whatever was done with the site was beneficial to the school. They wanted to maintain a tax base for the school. Things like that came up. And so we And then the next year, we had the decision that the dam was coming out. And so then it made it a little easier for the redevelopment group to specifically think, okay, now we know that the dam's coming out. Now what? And so that group did a lot of outreach, talked to the community, had a bunch of meetings, came up with a conceptual redevelopment plan, which was a state park. And that was in 2005. And then, 2006, 2007, end of 2007, we had a design charrette where we worked with landscape architects, folks from Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, about 30 people participated in the workshop, including a bunch of community residents. Came up with some ideas of, we want a park, what would it look like? And they really said, okay, we want benches here, we want trails there. It was really quite detailed. And the landscape architects drew up these nice pictures of what it could be. And so that was in 2008. And yeah, we've been actively seeking funding to make that conceptual plan a reality. And Fish, Wildlife, and Parks is stepping up, and the land is, we're in the process of transferring the Northwestern-owned, from Montana Power, Northwestern acquired the dam powerhouse and the reservoir lands. So the state of Montana is in the process of having those lands transferred to the state, and eventually they'll be transferred specifically within the state to Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. So that's all happening. Kind of cool.
So what made, going back to the beginning of that conversation, what made the EPA start thinking about redevelopment as opposed to just getting rid of toxins, but redeveloping sites, which you said happened in the late 90s?
I think it was, by the late 90s, Superfund program had been around for almost 20 years. And I think there was probably a recognition that, it's just not enough to clean up, remove the contamination or remove the exposure. We can't just leave these areas fenced off. Because I think by that point, we had probably fenced off a fair number of Superfund sites. And I don't know if there was public pressure or pressure from Congress or where, or just a recognition within the agency, I'm not sure, but it makes sense. I think, initially, if your house is on fire, you put out the flames, you don't worry about anything else. And so I think the initial part of the Superfund program was really about putting out fires, was getting those leaky drums, getting people on alternative water. Oh no, now what do we do? Quickly do something. And then after a while, it was like, yeah, we've done that. We kind of know how to do that, but now we need to finish the job. Mm-hmm.
So when you got the $40,000 seed money for the Bonner Redevelopment Group, were you working off of a model that you had seen happen in the EPA before, or was this, where did that come to you from?
It was the Milltown Redevelopment Working Group.
Okay.
BDG is a different group, but, and BDG, actually, we would have loved to have had Bruce Hall and participate in the group, but he didn't want to. But we had some other BDG members on the working group. When I was at headquarters in the early 90s, I worked on a. A friend of mine was working with federal facilities, and they were starting this new model called Restoration Advisory Boards, and also Citizens Advisory Boards, CABs and RABs, at federal facilities. So, there are Superfund cleanups going on at big Department of Energy and Department of Defense sites, huge ones. My friend, his name is Nick Morgan, he was working with, Tad McCall at DOD, and they had come up with this model where you'd have citizens on this board with the military to make decisions about the base, how the cleanup was going to occur. And he was a friend of mine, and we were talking. I'm like, oh, that's really interesting what you're doing. And so I talked to folks in Superfund, and we spun that model off for regular Superfund sites, and we call them community advisory groups. And so I knew a lot about these community advisory groups because it wasn't just me. I worked with a lot of people, but I written the initial EPA guidance on what are community advisory groups and how might they be formed and what might they accomplish. So I knew that well. And then coming out to Milltown and thinking, gosh, you know, there's such potential here. There's this community. And one really, I think, important thing that community advisory groups do is you get a group of people that regularly follow the project. And over time, that group becomes really well-informed. And they're friends and neighbors, and they live in the community. And when folks say, well, I heard, and they can say, well, yeah, but there's this other part to it. You know, they can really help keep the larger community better informed than mm-hmm. a few people from EPA or the state could ever do, because there's so many more of them. And it just, so I'm a big fan of these community advisory groups, because you really get an informed group that kind of follows the process, and they also can say, hey, there's this big community concern, have you guys thought about, you know, and hopefully early on identify those kind of concerns. And it's much, I mean, just like, you know, painting your wall and getting to the last corner and realizing, oh, I hate the color. If you found that out early, it's much easier to change. So the earlier we can identify community concerns, the earlier in the process, the better. So it's much easier to change course when you just drove out of the driveway than if you're down the street.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things I was asking you again before we started is about why is Milltown interesting? Why is it unique? I mean, is it unique, or is it just interesting? You know, if somebody down the line goes back and writes a history of Superfund mm-hmm. and Superfund cleanups, is Milltown going to figure in that as part of that bigger story, or is it just another example of sort of the process of Superfunds?
I think it's a good example of how Superfund should work. Mm-hmm. I don't think Superfund always works this well for any number of reasons. But and this is really corny, but we have joked that it's not only a project at the confluence of two rivers, but it's been a confluence of people and a confluence of events. And we've had a number of things. You know, I mentioned the 96 ice jam, and then we had, in the late 90s, we had the listing of the bull trout as an endangered species. We had the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission reclassification of the Milltown Dam as a high hazard dam, which meant that Northwestern would then be on the hook for potentially millions of dollars in upgrades on a dam that was aging and not producing much revenue, didn't produce much electricity. So the dam owner became receptive to taking out what they were seeing more and more as a liability rather than an asset. We had broad public support. You know, I think a lot of it initiated from, you know, the Two Rivers Park idea, you know, the Whitewater Park. So we had all those things coming together. And then we had Judy Martz, who was governor at the time, in her State of the State address in 2003, say she supported dam removal. And so all these things were coming together and really making it possible for EPA to propose dam and sediment removal. I mean, it's politics being what they are. If you're going to take out a dam in the western U.S., and your governor opposes you and the dam owner opposes you, I think that's a very hard road or mm-hmm. road to go down. But we had both. We had supported both. Mm-hmm. So, I'm sorry, I got kind of lost in that whole train of thought. Oh, the confluence. And then the confluence of people. We have had on this project a lot of people working and pushing in the same direction. We had, at the federal level, we had a bunch of agencies pushing for dam and sediment removal restoration of Two Rivers. The tribes were supportive. The state programs were supportive. The county was supportive. We had local environmental groups and the Trout Unlimited and Clark Fork Coalition, CFRTEC, and Friends of Two Rivers. And had so much support there. And then we had just the general public was very supportive. So it was really a confluence of all these things over a very few number of years, really. And to me, it's an example. What I think is unique about this project is, there's a number of things. One is the confluence of, you know, the rivers and the the people and the events. But it's also, it's the integration of the cleanup with the restoration and the redevelopment, all of that, we've been conscious of all three layers throughout the process. So when we're, it's not as simple as moving the dirt once, but it's kind of that idea. If well, we're doing removing the contaminated sediment and we can stockpile clean materials in a way, in a place where restoration can just kind of do some final grading without having to remove it, or if we know that the redevelopment group would like to see some trails, maybe the restoration program can take the restoration program can take that into account when doing the restoration plan. I mean, it's all, so kind of knowing where you want to be at the end and integrating that as you go is, I think that's another unique thing. And then probably the most amazing thing about this project is we have an opportunity to take a federal Superfund site and turn it into a state park. We have contaminated groundwater that we can restore within a decade after the source of contamination was removed, which we removed the last trainload of sediments in September of this year. So probably by September 2019, I mean, that's what we predict. We're not going to choose a date, and even saying a month is probably risky, but we should have clean groundwater. And we have Superfund sites across the country where we may never, at least knowing what we know now, we may never be able to clean it up. And here we can clean it up in a decade. We can restore two rivers. We can restore a fishery. You know, it's really the amount of environmental and public health good that we can do on this project is really kind of cool. So I think for all those reasons, it's a pretty unique project.
Mm-hmm. So is there anything that comes out of Milltown, at least since you've been working on it, that has become a model or an example for the rest of Superfund or potentially other Superfund sites? Is there anything that you and your job, when you go to other manage other projects, you'll say, well, you know, this worked at Milltown, or this is a precedent Milltown set that, you know, we ought to embrace as an agency or at least as a region?
Yeah, I think we put a lot of effort into making sure that people were involved and understood as we move through all our technical decisions. We set up a design review team with CFRTAC and the county and some other folks. Those are the two main ones, and the tribes, I'm sorry. And they would review draft design documents as we were designing the cleanup, and I think having that kind of, the redevelopment working group thinking about the long term and integrating remediation, restoration, and redevelopment, having all that kind of regular input by fairly well informed people really made it for a better project. And so I think we should do more of that. I think we should do we should continue. EPA does a better job of this now than we used to, but just being more upfront with people about what's going on and letting them, you know, look behind the curtain and see, well, how are those decisions being made, and actually be part of it. So I think Milltown's done a good job. I think we've done a good job at that, and then just integrating the three projects or the three parts of the project. So the Superfund law. And an attorney can tell you exactly, but it's not a bright line, but there is a line how far remediation can go. I mean, Superfund does not allow us to do a lot of work that would be considered restoration, and how that's defined is I think a big debate. another thing that we did in this project that I think was very smart was, we set up a consent decree with with ARCO, Northwestern, State of Montana, the tribes, and EPA. And it took about 3 years to negotiate. It took a long time. We finalized the consent decree in 2005, summer of 2005, but you know, work on that started 2002. And during that process, there were a lot of discussions about, well, what is restoration? Well, what is remediation? And where does that stop? And if remediation does this, is that saving restoration money? Well, if it is, then restoration should pay more. And it was just this whole, because it got down, what that document did was it laid out who did what and who paid for it. And then we had, as part of that consent decree, we had a very detailed scope of work, which spelled out exactly what that meant. Well, EPA will clean up and state will restore. Well, then the statement works at exactly what that meant. And worked into the consent decree was also some language about the redevelopment that would happen. And the redevelopment working group was mentioned in the consent decree, which is very unusual, having a community group mentioned and having some rights within that consent decree. So I think that was very smart, because all that was laid out. And so by the time we got to dam removal in 2000, record of decision in December of 2004, consent decree summer of 2005, and in 2006 we were hard at work trying to figure out what is the best way to take out this dam and remove the sediment. And it wasn't, I mean, we had some, you know, initial ideas with the details of how to do it, and it wasn't it didn't turn into an argument about money or it's not my responsibility, because it was all those arguments were already over. They were laid out, and all the discussions now focused on technical issues. Well, okay, you know, I know I have to pay for this, but what's the best way? And some people kind of roll up their sleeves and say, and there were very good discussions with EnviroCon, you know, the company, the construction company doing the work, EPA, the state, tribes, you know, everyone just really pushing to solve the problem. And I think that was very smart, and that should be done more. Trying to work that stuff out early, and so you can really just focus on the cleanup.
So I don't want to end by sort of smattering the poster perfect image of Milltown as, you know, the ideal cleanup site, but have there been any really challenging moments or failures in the process of Milltown that will stick out for you?
I think just
problems.
Yeah. Well, potential. I mean, one really tricky part, I think, that we identified early on. I did some community interviews in 2003 and 2002, and just talking to people, you know, ever since I've been on the project, we just talked to people. But and then I formally interviewed more people in 2006, and it was just so clear. People just had different values. I mean, some people really, and if people value things differently, some people really put a high value on free-flowing rivers and restored fishery. And other people said, I love the dam. My grandpa taught me to fish here. I love it. It's historic. It's part of our community. We don't want to see it go. And none of that has anything to do with environmental risk. It's just how you feel about it. And so, you know, there were wonderful stories. I know people, one lady told me about when she was a little girl, they would have air raid sirens go off during World War II, and they'd have to put up these heavy wool curtains over their windows to block out all light, because the Germans or the Japanese might bomb the Milltown Dam. And I thought, I mean, really, how likely was that? It was such a small dam, but this was part of what she remembered as a little girl. And it was an exercise that they all went through as part of World War II. And, you know, so people had, you know, and there's lots of pictures, historic pictures, but, you know, women in, you know, really improbable clothing trying to ice skate, or, you know, ice skating on the reservoir, you know, and so there's all that history. But when people's values are different, you know, and there, it's not like you could sort of take out the dam. It was either going or it was staying, and you could modify it. So that was, and it continues to be really challenging, especially, I don't know if you have a grandparent or a great-grandparent who, it changes harder when you get older. And so for people who had lived maybe their whole lives near the reservoir, that was a landscape they knew. And for them to see it go, I think that's hard.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you know, we can clean up a drinking water supply, restore the fishery, have some really nice opportunities, maybe have some positive economic impacts, property values. I mean, they're going to have, some people there are going to have really nice riverfront property, you know, I mean, along the Blackfoot, and it's clean, it's not dammed,
mm-hmm.
you know, so there's, anyway, so dealing with that, you know, people having very strong emotions, either pro or con, you know, about the dam removal. And one area that we I think we handled well, but potentially would have been a huge issue, was when we took out the dam, we were lowering the reservoir, had artificially kept the water table higher. We dropped we dropped the reservoir level 29 feet. And so that impacted people's wells. And so before we did that, this was, a very smart move. We hired a PhD student here at the university, Tony Berthelet, to do some modeling to figure out, well, what would happen hydrologically to, you know, what would happen to the water table in Milltown. And we identified, he went through well logs and worked with the county and DNRC, figure out, you know, who's got wells and where are they and how deep are they. So we had 13 feet deep wells, hand dug. And if you're dropping the reservoir, even with the initial drawdown, you know, like 10 feet, you're probably going to have a problem. And he identified wells that were priority. We had to replace these wells or either replace the wells or drop the pump to make sure that these folks didn't go out of water. Because if folks are on well and septic and you take away their water supply, that would have been a huge issue. But I mean, and every step of the process had potential pitfalls, but the project is on schedule, which I think is quite an accomplishment. I mean, Russ did a very good job managing the project. And I think because everyone's roles and the money was all worked out, there weren't arguments that could delay it. I mean, it's very easy if you get attorneys involved to maybe delay a process. And this was done largely without attorneys. I mean, after those decisions were made, it was just a bunch of people rolling up their sleeves trying to figure out how to get it done. Mm-hmm.
So. Was there anything else you would like to add that I haven't asked about that needs to be said about Milltown and your work there?
Oh, boy. You know, there's so much to talk about on this project. You ask good questions and you listen to me talk a lot. Here's the community involvement plan. Mm-hmm. Would you like?
Yeah.
You can have that copy if you want. And then I want to make sure. Have you seen this?
I have. That just got reissued. It's Judy Mattson from Bonner helped write that, and I've been in touch with her.
Okay. Well,
so that's a great resource.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to make sure you'd seen that too.
Well, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.